Hola, hola, hola. We're back at it, bringing you all of the Senora power all of the time. This is Sonia.
This is Sophia.
This is Gabby.
You are listening to episode three, part one of our series. And today we're focusing on activist senoras. You know the kind, the protester, the rabble-rouser, the fist raised high, take no prisoners kind of senora. And who better to focus on than the late, great Senora Alicia Escalante, a woman who founded more campaigns, committees, and conferences than the combined number of events we've probably attended in our whole lives. Much of our information about Senora Escalante's activism has been sourced from her personal collection at UC Santa Barbara, her oral history archived in Chicana Por Mi Raza, as well as the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and of course, the foundational work by Dr. Rosie Bermudez. All of these sources are linked in our episode description if you'd like to see more. And a quick content warning, we will be talking about racism, poverty, abuse, and drug addiction. So, how about we begin to learn the story of a woman who signed handwritten letters not with thank you, my best, nor regards, but with hasta la victoria, señora Escalante, or until victory. Escalante was born Alicia Lara in 1933 in El Paso, Texas. She remembers the city fondly. She calls it dusty and peculiar and friendly in her oral history. She recalls sitting at the railroad tracks near the Rio Grande, which is also the national border between the US and Mexico. She would toss pebbles back and forth over the river with Mexican children while regular freight trains rattled along the tracks. Her family life was intense, to say the least. As the second oldest of seven children, she was burdened with her parents' domestic affairs, specifically her father, Vincent Lara, a rigid authoritarian who was a diligent hard worker but frequently mentally abusive and controlling, as well as physically abusive towards both his wife and kids. After rampant infidelity and abuse, her mother, Guadalupe Lara, fled to California. She tried to take her children with her. However, Vincent was granted full custody of all the children because Guadalupe, or Lupe, was a traditional stay-at-home mom. She didn't have any kind of formal education. She didn't even have a birth certificate because she was orphaned at a young age. Guadalupe was incredibly kind and also submissive, the kind of person who never questions authority of any kind in any situation. So she was unable to advocate for her own custody or to prove that she had access to consistent employment and housing wherever she was going. Alicia felt this loss as a deep injustice. She was incredibly close to her mother as the oldest daughter. They had a special relationship, as Escalante later calls it, and this custody fissure marks Escalante's first encounter with the gaps in the US social system, as it did not protect her and her siblings from her father's abuse, while it penalized the gentle domestic characteristics of her mother. Meanwhile, Guadalupe had moved to LA to live with Alicia's aunt. Or so Alicia learned from a letter sent to her a few months after Guadalupe's departure. Her father, enraged at the situation, regularly beat Alicia, demanding information or that she snitch on her mom, basically. Escalante recalls a particularly bad beating that left her with a black eye as she ran to those same train tracks where she played at the border, determined to hop on a passing train and make her way from El Paso to California, which, for those unfamiliar with the geography, that's a 16-hour drive today. Imagine the commitment to do this. It was both incredibly reckless and amazingly brave. She had no idea where the train went. She only knew that it regularly came to El Paso. So she hops into this box car with a small bag of food and clothes. It's pitch black, and she just prays. At some point, she sees a small flame flick on opposite of where she's sitting. It's a stranger in the boxcar with her that she couldn't see. He tries to coax her into taking some food, to answering his questions, but she stays absolutely silent. He eventually leaves, and the next thing she remembers is being shaken away by Arizona police. Arizona. They try to send her back to her father, but he was very disinterested in her return and dismissively tells police if she wants to go to California, let her go then. So the police, who are actually kind of nice, contacted her tía, booked her a bus ticket, and ensured the driver would watch over her until she arrives. So begins her life in LA, where she remained for much of her time. This early foundational experience, Dr. Bermudez writes, taught Escalante that if she felt that something was unjust, she had the power and the mental and physical ability to challenge the injustice and to create change. It really is the catalyst for the next major life event, which determined a significant part of Escalante's life path. After Alicia arrives in California, Guadalupe relocates the family from her sister's home to a tiny place in downtown LA, while Guadalupe worked as a waitress at multiple restaurants for 36 to 50 cents an hour, about minimum wage. It was a struggle to survive, to make rent, to feed Escalante. Over the course of 3 years of this intense service work, her mother developed a severe disability from standing for such long hours. Her feet would swell until they caused her excruciating pain. She was even later placed in a charity ward at a local hospital where she was a victim of medical malpractice, another injustice Escalante writes about, because she quickly became her mother's medical advocate, forcing the doctors to continue treating Guadalupe until she was better. During this time of medical crisis, the pair were directed to the Los Angeles County Welfare Department by a local legal aid clinic. Escalante vividly recalls this early memory in her 1973 personal essay, Canto de Alicia, or Alicia Song. She begins the memoir with recollections of fear, anxiety, and isolation. Guadalupe struggled to walk and stand at the front desk of the welfare department. She spoke English, but struggled to converse with the Anglo receptionist. Escalante remembers the severe coldness of the receptionist, who refused to speak with Escalante as her mother's medical advocate. She argued with her back and forth, refusing to allow Escalante to speak on Guadalupe's behalf. She repeatedly told Alicia with much hostility, no, there is nothing we can do for her. Until 12-year-old Escalante was able to talk with a supervisor in the office who provided a form to fill out. They eventually received minimal welfare benefits after much waiting time, both in the office and as the claim was filed. Escalante dubs these begrudgingly given benefits tokens, or pennies in the face of increasing medical debt and cost of living. This entire experience left Escalante angry and anxious and alone, and most importantly, aware. She became aware of an office within a system that had stripped her mother of her dignity, of her respect, an office that was intended to be a resource or an assistance tool meant to help people in times of crisis and financial burden. Was a hostile space prejudiced against single mothers like Guadalupe. But I want to stop here and ask you both two questions. The first is for Sophia. Yes, could you broadly define the US welfare system, specifically for someone who might be new to this country or just sort of learning about these large US infrastructures?
Broadly defined, the US welfare system is just a system designed to help, poor people in the country. Some of them immigrants, a lot of them, native born people. But It's really, I think it's one of the essential roles of government. Even when we think about the welfare system, we often think about like socialism and like all these other kinds of governmental structures. But I think that it's one of the most essential functions of the government, right, to provide for its people. So this is a system that's designed in terms of medical aid, in terms of housing aid, in terms of providing certain low-cost resources for working class people or people beyond the poverty level.
Excellent. Thank you. So, build off that, Gabby, and could you define for our audience maybe some myths that you've encountered or that they listeners might have heard about the welfare system?
Yeah, the welfare system has always been really fraught. Well, it has been fraught since the 1940s or 1950s in the United States. I think, we should remember that the US had a very strong labor organizing and socialist, if you want, history in the 1930s and 1920s. So this stigmatization of this kind of system, like the welfare system, which it has its bases in socialized government, the stigmatization of that didn't really start until the 1950s when McCarthyism became big. And for those of you listening who don't identify the word McCarthyism, what it refers to is the government, specifically the FBI, gathering information on its own citizens and trying to imprison, deport, or punish citizens that identified as communist or socialist, because it was a time period during which international politics pitted the United States and countries that were considered communist against each other. So this is kind of the global side of why we now have a distrust of communism, socialism, and by extension, why socialized systems such as welfare could be seen with suspicion in the popular vernacular, but specifically some myths that end up happening as a mixture of this fear of socialism and communism, plus the racism that's ingrained in the US system. And of color see themselves overly impacted by the kind of cycle of quote unquote cycle of poverty, or like the idea that you can't go up a social class if you don't have certain privileges. And so a lot of racist media and some US presidents from the 1980s until present have furthered the image of women of color taking advantage of the welfare system gratuitously. So like instead of saying like, oh, I actually need this help, like that they're just not even trying to work, not even trying to do anything, for example, and that that makes them undeserving somehow of aid, of survival. And when in fact it's a lot more complicated than this, because of the way that our system fails people of color, specifically women of color.
Yes, I don't know if either of y'all have watched Parks and Rec, but there's a character, Ron Swanson, who's like kind of a mouthpiece for this sort of rhetoric. He's funny and like lovable in like the overall narrative, but he very much sort of points to the way that people suckle on the teat of like the US like the US infrastructure. And yeah, it's this idea that people who are using these social services as their primary income, for example, are like undeserving, lazy, greedy, like all these like negative stereotypes, rather than, as Sophia pointed out, it's sort of a social net to ca catch people.
I just wanted to point out really quickly that these attitudes or these myths around like welfare programs are not exclusive to the US, right? So currently in Mexico, Mexican politics, right, there's this discourse around the ninis, the people who are ni estudiantes ni trabajadores or something like that, and they're just kind of like coasting off of government assistance, supposedly, right? But as we know, based on experience and history and facts, that assistance often amounts to very small That assistance is often very
Tokens.
small. Tokens, as Alicia would say. So, Sonia, how does Alicia define the welfare system in the US?
Well, she sums it up with this quote that I think is great. Welfare is an ugly system, and I sensed it and have always sensed the need to expose it. But forces are so powerful, there's only one thing that I can do: face it, write it, communicate it in any and every way that I can. Which is exactly what she does. So I'm going to take us through some of the different ways that Escalante uses her voice as a señora to confront the welfare system, to write about it, to talk about it, and to advocate for her community. So first, we have to begin with her own becoming of a single teenage mother when she meets Antonio Tony Escalante at 17 years old. He's a few years older than her and very interested in marriage. Despite her mother's warnings that Tony was, quote, not a good man, Escalante marries him and begins having babies soon after. She went into this relationship completely naive. She did not know of birth control's existence, nor did she understand the reality of Tony's heroin addiction. She actually had no idea what heroin was at all. She was a teenager with little exposure to the outside world. But she had five children with Tony, and he was incarcerated or absent for much of their marriage. And by 1962, Escalante was, by many definitions, a single mother, back at the welfare office, but this time for herself. With her own welfare tokens, her five children, and her aging mother, Escalante found herself once again struggling to survive. It was at this point in her journey when she met Dr. Carlo, a family physician and disabled rights activist. Not only did he treat Escalante and her family with respect and dignity, but he encouraged her to attend a local demonstration protesting then California Governor Ronald Reagan's medical cutbacks. He had produced cutbacks to Medi-Cal, which is California's Medicaid program. Medi-Cal was established in 1965, and it provided all kinds of medical services like dental and vision, hospitalization and emergency services, things like that, to low-income communities. Around 1.5 million Californians depended on this social program. Governor Reagan made multiple cutbacks from 1967 to the early 1970s. He cut over $210 million in funding and available medical services. He limited Medi-Cal patient numbers per physician. He increased bureaucratic red tape. He was sued, actually, by a group of doctors who were deeply critical of these state laws, undermining Medicaid's utility because it was a federal program. It should have been available for all U.S. citizens, is the rule at the time. So Dr. Carlo was one of those vocal medical critics, and he saw in Escalante not just a poor client, but someone who could make a real difference for people in need. In fact, Escalante, who had no idea what demonstrating or protesting really even was, speaks so highly of Dr. Carlo because he did everything possible to get her to that protest. He paid for her transportation to get there, and he will return later in the story because once Escalante arrives on the scene of the Medi-Cal protest, she never looks back from organizing. She says it was at this event that she picked up a demonstration sign and felt so empowered that she didn't know what she was going to do, but she was going to do something. The Medi-Cal activists, most of whom were Black and Mexican American, welcomed her into their group and soon elected her to be the representative of East LA, where over a quarter of households qualified for Medi-Cal. And as this representative, she began working with the National Welfare Rights Organization, or NWRO, which was created in 1966 to fight for increased assistance and control over welfare regulations. Black single mothers were the core and the leaders of this organization. They specifically fought against laws that decreased the number of welfare recipients and the size of benefits. It was with this group that Escalante began working with the director, Johnny Tillman, and South LA activist, Catherine Germaine. From these organizers, Escalante learned strategies to navigate the welfare administrators, such as how to not allow them to simply say, "No, we can't help you," and turn mothers away. She learned to instill confidence in women who were fearful of repercussions. She would tell them, quote, "What will you lose? You're already not getting anything from them." The women of NWRO taught Escalante how to go door to door, how to network, and how to teach people about the rights of the federal government that the federal government had granted them, but the state of California was denying. Escalante then founded her own auxiliary organization in 1967, which she named East Los Angeles Welfare Rights Organization, alternatively called La Causa de los Pobres, or the Poor People's Cause, which focused on welfare recipients of Mexican-American descent. Of this work, she writes, East LA Welfare Rights Organization started with one mad madrecita and ended up with a whole lot of mad madresotas. We have Chicano machos fighting alongside with us. I guess they decided if you can't beat them, join them. And join us they did, because we're in all of this together. Liberation of the system, that's where it's all at. Neither of us can do it alone, so we can and must do it together. So before I go further, what are your responses to this quote, to Escalante's journey into welfare rights activism? How do you see her using her señorahood to do this work, or learning from the NWRO organizers? What are your thoughts?
As a eldest daughter of Mexican immigrants who also is from El Paso and everything, it resonates with me, you know, the kind of struggle that she goes through and the kind of figuring out that happens when you're put in that position. All of a sudden, there's documents in an entirely new language, not only English, but legalese. Like, it's a different thing to apply for government assistance as a working class person, as an immigrant person, as a poor person, right? As a woman of color specifically. So it's very helpful for me to hear about Alicia's background in this way, because I'm like, oh, that's where her señora strategies come from, that lived experience of having to figure it out and knowing that you're not the only one who's trying to figure this stuff out.
Yeah, I agree, Sophia, with the fact that it really comes through that idea of like tener que resolver, like having to fix things and kind of do the stopgap thing of like, I need to survive every day. It's really rascuachismo is what it is. You know, it's exactly what this person who wrote about rascuachismo in a big way, Tomás Ibarra Frausto, he says that it's kind of the thing you have to do every day to keep going, like the car breaks or you have a leak in your house or whatever, but you're like, okay, that's fine, gonna keep going. And just for anyone who doesn't know, rascuache is a slang word that's used in some parts of Mexico and in, like, you know, a lot of Chicano communities to talk, or immigrant communities as well, to talk about something that doesn't work right or something that's kind of like on the cheaper side or kind of thrown together. And so for a lot of people, it feels like it's a negative thing. But the way that Tomás Ibarra Frausto wrote about it, the way that a lot of Mexican and Mexican-American people, like in younger generations, have used it too, is kind of a solidarity building thing, where it's like we're all trying to survive together. And even if it looks thrown together, it's still good. And I think that I see this in Alicia Escalante's quote, when she is basically putting together her organizing philosophy, where she says, the Chicanos didn't have to agree with us at first. The only thing we needed was each other, and each other in that way was the mothers, right? Like madrecitas, madresotas, right? And I think that that's really cool how she uses that as a community identity.
So now we find her in 1967. She is neck deep in organizing. She actually returns to see Dr. Carlo from earlier. I told you he'd be back. And he asks her, well, did you go to that protest? Which is like funny for us knowing how deeply she went to the protest. And he was so happy. He was more than happy when she told him about her organization, the East Los Angeles Welfare Rights Organization. So he decided to set her up in a vacant office across the street from his practice where he would pay the rent and she could use his office's phone, printer, and mailing supplies. It was with Dr. Carlos' support that Escalante could become a full-time welfare rights organizer. And she became incredibly well-known for her activism. In 1968, she was invited to participate in the Poor People's Campaign. In her oral history, she tries to recall who invited her, but can only remember his first name, Jesse. And the interviewer, Kelly Navy, says, "Do you mean Jesse Jackson?" And Escalante's like, yeah, that's right. Which, for those of you who don't know, Reverend Jesse Jackson is a prominent civil rights activist, very iconic. And Jackson ended up paying for Escalante's travel and food, as well as many other organizations, including the Brown Berets. And it was there that she listened to amazing lectures by Martin Luther King Jr. and John Lewis. She spent time with Corky Gonzalez and other Chicano activists. The Poor People's Campaign was really about bringing as much national attention to poverty and the cycle of poverty that Gabby mentioned earlier. But the same year, Escalante would split with NWRO over differences in priorities. Escalante had been pushing for Spanish language translation of welfare reforms to be made a priority for the overall organization. She felt that Chicanos were affected more by certain legislation, such as a directive that denied welfare benefits to non-citizens or to undocumented peoples. So she splits from the group in 1969 and founds the Chicano Welfare Rights Organization, CWRO. It is with this organization that she hammers home her point that Spanish-speaking welfare recipients don't know what forms they are signing, they don't know what rights they have, some social workers won't even talk to them, even if they wait for entire days in the waiting room. In Canto de Alicia, she writes, "The welfare picture will eventually come out if we, as mujeres, madres, chicanas, get together and communicate and help each other. The road of the welfare mother is a lonely one, and our hermanas, no matter what walk of life they come from, will have to join." So going back to the Chicanos, or the men who are, you know, taking part in the Chicano movement at this exact same time, she calls them out. Or the people at least who refuse to join or who buy into the welfare myths that we talked about earlier. In a letter titled "My Own People Discriminate," she writes, "My own people discriminate against the recipient on welfare. The Anglo establishment very shrewdly brainwashed them that way to separate the working class Chicano from the non-working one. They've separated the poor from the more fortunate, the educated from the non-educated, and so on. We cannot afford to let that happen any longer. We are all one raza, one race, one familia. Whether we come from the suburbs or the barrio, the untogether Mexicano that won't accept this is because he is afraid to face the truth, to face reality. He feels safer in an Anglo society. For this one, I say, I hope you come home someday. And if you don't, I wish you buena suerte. Good luck. You're gonna need it. If this sounds like racism, you draw your own conclusions. I accept Anglos in the background if they stay in their place." Okay. There's so much to say about that quote. Okay, it's a lot to deconstruct. She was mad. She was a mad madrecita, as she says. But before I give you a chance to respond, I want to give you one more. Because remember that Escalante's goal is to get as much community and media attention as possible on this issue. Her goal was to confront it, to face it, to write about it. So she writes all kinds of organizations. She applies for grants from the local nonprofits and from the Catholic Church. So here's another handwritten letter in her archive. I know you both are going to remember it. It's simply titled Monseigneur Berry. I don't know if I said that right, very French. Monseigneur Berry. And it goes, "Your denial of the proposal was of no surprise to me personally. It was exactly what I expected from the Catholic Church, one of the sickest churches in the world. Having had the experience of being interviewed for less than 5 minutes, was not even given the courtesy of a site visit to the office to see the hardcore problems we deal with daily with all our sweat and tears involuntarily, it came as no surprise. The hypocritical attitude of concerns that was not really there was so obvious. It is I that feel sorry for all of you, priests, reverends, ministers, and the like that have used the church in the name of God for a comfortable way of living. You, sir, are the agency. You are the establishment. All of a sudden, the churches are interested in the humane development of people. 100 years too late. You may be able to buy off some people, but you can never undo all the harm the churches have done. And ignoring the problems, the poverty, the discrimination, the racism, the hunger and needs of the poor. In a sense, I am glad you didn't give us a cent. I will add it to my last experience with the Catholic Church. We will continue our work, God's real work. Signed, Senora Alicia Escalante. Okay, I'm gonna take a break. I'm gonna take a breath. I threw a lot of quotes at you. We've got the split with NWRO, the call to Chicanas, her first real time, by the way, using this political identity label that we've seen in her absolute drag of the Catholic Church and Chicanos and the Anglo establishment. So, what are your thoughts? How are you thinking of these?
I mean, she's daring, she's angry, she is out there telling all of the truths and calling people out, and not in like a negative way, like you said that you're gonna do this thing, you say that this is your mission, and you're not acting on that mission. So I don't know, I'm thinking about a whole bunch of like different things here. One of the main critiques about the Chicano movement that has come out in recent years is this attention to political unity, right? The idea that all Chicanos, all Mexican American people have to come together and they're this one identifier and we're all working towards the same things. But here, Alicia is very clearly pointing to the difference between the educated Chicano, the non-educated Chicano, the wealthy Chicano, the poor Chicano, right? And so it's very obvious that this notion of unity is just like an ideal, like an organizing concept, but materially, we're not there yet. At least, I mean, in 1969, right? We're definitely not there yet. And so it reminds me of the previous quote that you shared with us, Sonia, about the fight to liberate ourselves from the system. Right? She doesn't name the system, but she's consistently calling out different kinds of systems that maybe like diminish difference, that are not attentive to intersectional and complex issues. So I don't know. I like Alizia. I love her.
Yeah, Alicia's always a good time. She is always saying it like she sees it. I think that the issue you raise, Sophia, that's been raised over and over with Alicia's writing of unity versus fragmentation, right? Or unity versus non-unity in the Chicano movement, I think is at the crux of the issues that a lot of Chicanos had to face, namely Alicia here. Where it's, I think, like basic organizing, I guess, best practice always calls for finding commonalities among oppressed peoples in order to build coalitions and have greater power when you're going up against the system, whatever that system might be. I think it's also really important to note that Alicia's pointing out that the concept of unity was weaponized against a lot of Chicanas, specifically like single mothers, or not that Alicia says this, but as we know, like a lot of lesbianas, like Chicana lesbian feminists, like a lot of female activists. And I mean, in more recent years, a lot of non-binary and trans immigrants and Mexican American people have also felt excluded by the movement in the name of this kind of idea of unity, right? Like, of we all have to organize together And even though I think we all have to organize together, it has been proved like that concept has been proved time and time again by the señoras that we're looking at. Like we all have a power together. That may be true, but it does not mean, like you're saying, Sophia, that we all have to identify as the same thing. And I think that's the thing that we're seeing here is that Alicia's call to action had to do with a lot with class and a lot with gender.
Yes, thank you. I think all of those comments were super helpful to pull apart and sort of understand these quotes that might be like quite shocking for a lot of people, a lot of listeners. Like, why would she say something that intense, you know? And I think y'all have done a really great job of explaining exactly why. Okay, well, this has been just one story of Senora Power. I also have to admit, I'm such an Escalante stan. I think she's incredible. She makes me feel hyped, amped to go out there and make some noise. Up next, we have part two of Activist Senoras, where we learn about Escalante's Houston counterpart, Maria Jimenez. So you don't want to miss that because Jimenez was not somebody to play with either. So, hasta la victoria!